Welcome to the Hirschfeld Century Podcast. I'm Catherine Eastman, the Archives Manager of the Al Hirschfeld Foundation.
And I'm David Leopold, the Creative Director.
And today we have a new episode for you celebrating Warner Brothers film
100 years.
Centennial, yep.
And this is actually, surprisingly, there's a lot of Hirschfeld stories to go with this.
That's great. And early stories.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, we identified maybe about 80 drawings he did for Warner Brothers. I'm sure there's more. And more than half of them all are drawn before 1930.
Now, do the drawings start in 1923?
No, the drawings don't start in 1923. They start in 1925.
So he was there from almost the beginning.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, of course, this is all part of his origin story. As anybody who's listened to this podcast knows, Hirschfeld started working in the movie industry in 1920, and by 1924, he was the art director of Selznick Pictures.
Right.
He is a whopping 20 years old.
That's wild. Can you imagine?
I can't imagine. He is 20 years old when Selznick goes bankrupt, and he is left holding the bag for a lot of bills, which... instead of walking away, he is determined to pay them. He goes to a party at Carl Van Vechten's and meets a 19-year-old guy who's just come from Mexico, Miguel Covarrubias. They hit it off. They take a studio together because they both need a studio to work in. And what Hirschfeld's working on when he's in a studio with Covarrubias is drawings for Warner Brothers, almost exclusively. I mean, for a while, he is just supplying them drawings. Now, we don't know all the drawings that he did for Warner Brothers. We're still trying to track down press books because that's where we're going to see the images. Newspaper clippings would be good, but you'd have to look up every release.
Yeah, and a lot of this early stuff isn't signed either.
Exactly.
So you really, and these are also still straight drawings primarily.
Yes.
Just they're pen and ink portraits of that look relatively quote-unquote normal.
Yeah, traditional.
Right.
Traditional. And, you know, I've looked at enough of these that I have a pretty good sense of his straight drawing from this period.
It's much harder to do, but yeah, there's definitely still a style he has.
Right. There are things that could be Hirschfeld, but we can't say for sure. But then there are the pieces that he had copies of in his studio, which is, to me, a sure sign that he drew them.
Right.
But I don't think he has everything because, especially with the movie work, there wasn't something, you know, in the newspapers, he would get the newspaper, he would cut out the clipping, put it on a pile, and that was great. But the movie work wasn't exclusive to New York. In fact, it went mostly all around the country.
Right.
And Hirschfeld did not have a clipping service. And of course, even if he did, they wouldn't have picked up a drawing he did for a film that didn't have his name on it or his name wasn't in the caption.
Right.
And in the 1920s, nobody was saying Hirschfeld's drawn this or Hirschfeld's drawn that because the Hirschfeld that they would have been thinking about is Harry Hirschfeld, no relation, but he was a figure in New York at that time and a cartoonist.
And just like the films from that era that don't survive, a lot of the printed material doesn't survive either. Whether it's newspapers or press books or the movie posters, that's why that stuff is so collectible. Nobody thought to keep all of that. Nobody thought it was important.
Exactly. And there was so much of it that no one thought that anybody would need it. First of all, it had no secondary value to them. And no one thought that something so ubiquitous was, you know, you wouldn't be able to find it.
Right.
But in some cases, Hirschfeld's drawings of these films are some of the only visual documentation we have of the films.
Yeah, that happens with the theater work too. You know,
right.
a flop show that only ran one night, but it's got a great drawing.
Yes.
And that happens too in these early film pieces.
Right, exactly. And in a way, this was it was almost like theater. Because, you know, you were a studio, you put out a new film every week.
Wow.
That was the way it was. So if you were a big hit, you made it through the whole week. Maybe they held it over for a week or two. But most films, people went to the movies. You know, you watch TV on a Friday night or a Saturday night. Well, there was no TV at that time.
Right.
They would just go to the movies.
Wild. Meanwhile, we've been waiting for Barbie and Oppenheimer for months. This was the 20s. That would have come and gone already.
Come and gone. We wouldn't have even thought about it. And in some ways, I mean, they were doing all kinds of films. As I was preparing for this episode, I would say, oh, here's a Rin Tin Tin title. And Rin Tin Tin is a huge a star for Warner Brothers. It really puts them on the map, makes them become a major studio. Before that, they were kind of struggling. And then this dog, of all things, becomes his first films become a huge hit for them. And I think it's telling that Hirschfeld is drawing Rin Tin Tin in 1927 for Warner Brothers. Again, at first, straight drawings of Rin Tin Tin. But the films that he drew, While London Sleeps, for instance, which was, I think, 1927, that film doesn't exist. Jaws of Steel, I think only parts of it exist. So Hirschfeld's drawings, which I'm sure were taken from photographs, really give us a sense of what these films were like. We have examples of how they were used in advertising. But, you know, there's literally a portrait of Rin Tin Tin that was put in the press book that you would cut out the two-column drawing of Rin Tin Tin.
Oh, cute.
So he's working in an art department full. I mean, one of the things that we found was he drew really very early caricatures in a much more traditional form of caricature of the fellow members of the art department. There was a guy. I tried to research these guys, and of course, all but one of them completely lost to history.
Just nobodies, yeah.
Yeah. They were somebody's uncle or father or grandfather, but they they haven't put anything online. I looked all kind of different ways, different spellings. The only figure I could find anything about was the art director of the publicity department at Warner Brothers was a guy by the name of George Bronte. And he did these funny little books where they were these poems about, you know, simple things. They were children's books. And Hirschfeld's drawing, I don't know whether it's intentional or not, but it sort of recreates that, where he calls them the old gray sweater. You know, it's been running on Broadway since, you know, for a long time. Because he had been part of the sort of Broadway world. Not necessarily theater, but the Broadway world.
Sure.
And he became art director when Warner Brothers started. And so he was really, in some sense, Hirschfeld's first boss in an art department that he stayed in. You know, we know he was at Universal, but he didn't stay there long.
Gotcha.
So it's in Warner Brothers that he's doing straight drawing. He's doing it for popular pictures. The first work that he does is for a 1925-1926 yearbook, which was the book that salesmen took to theaters around the country with this idea of, okay, we're going to be doing these movies, even though the movies probably were not written, were not cast, or were not made. And Hirschfeld did, strangely enough, designs for the margins of the pages. And they're fascinating. There's just these... sometimes they're images of people or...
Yeah, it's like decorative elements.
Right.
It's kind of like, it reminds me of the... It's not the same thing, but it reminds me of that, the Selznick brochure he did. He did the cover of that. And you're like, what do you mean he did the cover of it? It's just text and a bunch of, like, junk on the cover. But no, he designed all of the little things on it. So, and this is kind of a similar thing. It's not a drawing, per se.
No, there are drawings. They're just these...
But
just...
it's not... It's not the focus.
Right.
It's extra. It's the borders. It's the
decorative
edges of the page. Yeah.
And it's done in a very loose pen style.
Mm-hmm.
Again, representational, but constrained. And you could read it. You know, it looked good, even though it was quite small. So, again, we don't know where some of these things were actually published.
Right.
But that might be the very first piece that he did for Warner Brothers. And not that it is, you know, we don't want to do, and then he drew, and then he drew, and then he drew. I did, when I was researching this, I did look at some old Warner Brothers press books, and lo and behold, I found a Hirschfeld drawing signed of the director Ernst Lubitsch. And I immediately thought, 3 years later, he draws Lubitsch for the Film Daily yearbook. and it's a caricature. And, you know, just in these two drawings, you can see, wow, this guy has traveled a long way.
Oh, cool.
You know,
drawing the same person.
The same person.
Yeah, because I wonder if that has, that doesn't happen a lot.
No.
I'm trying to think who else might be.
Well, Rin Tin Tin, he does eventually caricature.
That's true, yeah. It's a little different, though.
Feta Bera, we know that he eventually caricatures, but no.
Yeah,
it's really rare.
Happen. Interesting. I never thought of that. You know, can you see someone drawn straight by Hirschfeld and then caricatured?
The only other one I can think of, he did a piece for MGM of Katharine Hepburn in a film called Undercover, I believe.
Oh, interesting.
And it was very much a much straighter drawing.
Mm.
I mean, you can tell that there's Hirschfeld in it, but it's done pretty straight. Sort of like the National Velvet pastel portraits of Elizabeth Taylor and Mickey Rooney. They are kind of caricature, but they're not really.
They're much more straight than caricature, for sure.
And both of those figures, Mickey Rooney and Elizabeth Taylor,
plenty to compare those to.
But a director... rare to be drawn in the first place. True. To have two different versions of him.
That's neat.
Is I think, really good.
Good find, David.
Oh, well, my day is made, folks.
Yeah, I don't give those out very often.
It's been close to 10 years now.
Now, the first caricatures he ever published were from Warner Brothers films.
Yes, and what's interesting is these are also instances where we can see what his caricatures look like and what his straight drawings look like, because... we have straight drawings of Cindy Chaplin in Man on the Box.
Oh, well, that's just what I was asking.
Right, but...
I just asked if there were other examples. I didn't think there were any. Oh, yeah, here's two more.
I didn't think of it until you said it.
I see. You're slipping. Got to keep you on your toes.
One would hope that you looked at the notes, too.
Oh, I see that. Also, straight drawings of same films.
Yeah.
There we go.
And
there you have it, folks.
And so, and at this time, he's doing caricature as sort of a additional thing that he can do.
Mm.
But it's the straight drawings that are the big thing.
Yeah.
He would do caricatures sort of in addition to, but it's the straight drawings that are the things that were really the focus of his work. In 1926, he does John Barrymore in Don Juan, actually a couple of the figures from that film. And that film, while it's not The Jazz Singer, is the first feature-length film to utilize the Vitaphone sound-on-disc sound system with synchronized musical store and sound effects.
Ah, yes. We all know what that means.
Well, it's one of the first times a film is shown in which you can hear what's going on the screen.
Okay.
On the screen.
That's an easy way to explain it to a fifth grader. I like that.
Or Catherine Eastman, yes. Whatever comes first.
Explain it to me like I'm five.
And then other people that he drew in this early period, which I think are funny, are Jason Robards Sr.
Mm.
He, of course, would do many drawings of Jason Robards Jr., who was such an important figure in mid-20th century Broadway.
Right.
But, I mean, only Hirschfeld is around to be drawing the father.
Yeah.
In a Rin Tin Tin film.
Oh, there you go.
Other early people, Myrna Loy is in a lost film called Bitter Apples. I figure that shows up repeatedly in this early work because he was an early Warner Brothers star and today is completely forgotten. Monty Blue.
Oh, no, there's plenty. And there's that really great one. Is it Red Hot Tires?
Or Red
is
Hot
that
what it's Tires.
Called? That's a great drawing. That's the one I'm thinking of where he's got his hand up and he's smiling and laughing. That's a great drawing.
Oh, it is really great. And his co-star in that movie is Patsy Ruth Miller, which means... little to anybody except she was the female lead in Lon Chaney's Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Oh, interesting.
So she has sort of survived in history because let me tell you, they don't play Red Hot Tires much anymore.
I wonder if it does exist.
I looked.
Of course, I knew you looked it up. So
Library of Congress or UCLA, you can go to one of them and see it. But you know, when you look at these early caricatures by Hirschfeld. There's another one for a film called How Baxter Butted In.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that.
And they're very sketchy.
Yeah.
You know, It looks like maybe he's drawing with charcoal instead of a pen. You know, but he's not using a pen for sure on some of the early
ones. The Monty Blue one, too, seems more charcoal. Yeah. It does it not, yeah.
And then he would do some straight ink ones. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he didn't really commit to line for a while because you can see in the theater drawings, you know, when we look at Albert Carroll in 1927, 1928, Rangtang, of course, these lines are outlined with charcoal.
Yeah.
So he hadn't committed completely to just the line. As we know, it would take until his trip to Bali. But you see George Jessel. There's actually another person that you see as a straight drawing and as a caricature. But again, this is like looking, this is peering into a portal into a lost world.
Yeah.
Because almost nothing of these films exist. Mm. And the only reason we know that Hirschfeld drew them in many cases because he had, you know, I found in his studio some copies of something. Mm. Or some notation that led me to look. University of Wisconsin in Madison has some Warner Brothers press books on microfilm. And I had a fun couple of days looking through those.
I believe it.
And then in the 30s, he does one or two pieces that we've documented. Same thing in the 40s.
Do you think this is due to the rise of MGM?
I think there's two things. Yes, he's doing much more work for MGM at this point. He signs this guarantee. Well, he doesn't sign. He agrees to a $15,000 guarantee with MGM.
Which they always went over, he said.
Yes. And so he Hirschfeld wanted to draw. And to a great extent, who he was drawing for, he didn't really care because he was going to get paid pretty much the same from either studio.
Gotcha.
Just MGM had guaranteed him the work, and so why not go with them?
Of course.
But he's still, in 1927, when he starts with MGM, he's still doing a lot of work for Warner Brothers.
What do you think the other reason is?
The other reason is we just don't know. As I said, there's probably lots of work that he did that we still don't know about.
Gotcha.
Because nothing of those films exist, or it's needle in a haystack. Yeah. You could look through every Warner Brothers film released between 1925 and 1940, and it would be fascinating to look through every press book if they existed. But the fact is, you could look through almost all of them and find nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Or something that Hirschfeld did in a style that was appropriate for the film, but does not read as Hirschfeld.
Right, it doesn't read as Hirschfeld.
And, you know, your eyes glaze over at a certain point as you're looking through this.
Yeah. I think there's a third reason.
What is that?
He starts drawing theater.
Yes, although that you would think that, but he's doing all these drawings for MGM while he's drawing the theater.
That's true.
He's drawing for RKO. He's drawing for
Pathé. I'm just saying, he's added another genre now.
Well, I think
another industry.
Yes.
And now he's drawing for the newspapers and such.
But if we look at the drawings he did for newspapers in 1927 and even in 1928, it's not a lot.
No, we're talking about the 30s now.
Oh, well, so the 30s. Of course, now he's doing it for three New York newspapers.
That's what I'm saying.
But this is a man who's in his late 20s, early 30s. He's got I knew him in his 80s and 90s, and his capacity for work was startling, you know. So I can only imagine what he was like 50 years earlier. Mm. He loved to draw.
I just wanted to throw my theory in the ring.
Well, that is why we call you Dr. Eastman. No, what's interesting is, he doesn't really do much in the 30s.
Yeah, like he ended his relationship with Warner Brothers. It was just MGM was paying him more or guaranteed more, and he was doing all this other stuff, and maybe, you know, I don't know.
I mean, when Hirschfeld didn't have an assignment on his table, I know later in his career, you know, starting in the 1970s, if he didn't have something, he would call up an art director of a publication or a studio, and he would say, "What's cooking?"
Mm.
And, you know, Al Hirschfeld's calling you. You figure out something for him to do.
Yeah.
Now, was it like that in the 1930s? I don't think so. But even in the 1930s, he had already established himself as such a reliable worker. But also his drawings were already very compelling. You know, this isn't something where he spent years sort of... if he had spent years doing drawings like Sidney Chaplin and Man in the Box or Hal Buck,
if he never progressed, yeah.
If that was a slow, steady thing, no, he wouldn't do it. But remember, in 1938, when he draws the Frank Capra's film version of You Can't Take It With You, the studio takes out a full-page ad, and the text of that ad that runs alongside eight drawings by Hirschfeld is really not about the film. Mm. It's about that Hirschfeld's doing it.
Yeah.
So you can just tell that already by 1938, he's big enough that they thought that, okay, this would be interesting for people to read. And that he really was, he was Hirschfeld already. And in 1938, he's 35 years old. So it's pretty incredible. So, no, he doesn't have any big break with Warner Brothers. It's I think these occasional drawings that we know of probably came about because he was bored and needed something to do. And so he called up and they said, yeah, there's a film with Kay Kaiser and Boris Karloff in a film called You'll Find Out in 1940. Mm. He did two drawings for this film. And I'm sure it was kind of a fun film. So you gave a comedy to Hirschfeld. That seemed like a very natural thing
right.
to do.
You're not going to give Gone with the Wind to Hirschfeld in 1939.
Doesn't probably exactly not. Yeah.
Fit the mood.
No, but then you just give him Wizard of Oz because that's right up his alley.
Well, of course that is right up his alley.
Yeah.
It's not as serious and as dark as Gone with the Wind, I think.
So in the 1960s, for whatever reason, well, I think I know the reason. Warner Brothers starts turning to Hirschfeld to do drawings of films for publicity. And most of the films that he draws are film adaptations of stage hits.
Mm.
My Fair Lady with Who? Audrey. My Fair Lady?
I'm kidding. No.
I have to work with her. It's just hard. He draws My Fair Lady with Audrey Hepburn and Rex Harrison. Any Wednesday, I think it's his first drawing of Jane Fonda. And who is she with? Jason Robards Jr.
There you go.
So
full circle.
40 years later, he's drawing the sun. And it's not his first drawing of Jason Robards Jr., but it's one of the first mm-hmm. ones. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Now, what's interesting about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, he did a great drawing for publicity, which was purchased and owned by Mike Nichols.
Mm. The director of...
Yes, the director of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. But then he does a different drawing of the film for Life magazine.
Mm.
You know, just because they were doing some feature on it. And let's get Hirschfeld to draw.
Of course.
He does film adaptations of Camelot.
Camelot. Say it again.
Camelot.
I think the people will like that.
And then finally, Finian's Rainbow with, of all people, Fred Astaire and Petulia Clark.
Mm.
And those last two are not known as great film adaptations. Mm. But he hadn't drawn Finian's Rainbow when it was on Broadway originally because it premieres on Broadway when he's going around the world with S.J. Perlman.
The lost months.
9 months.
I was going to say years, but I know it's not years.
Longest time he's away from Broadway. And then Camelot, of course, he did draw a very famous drawing with Richard Burton, Julie Andrews, Robert Goulet, and Roddy McDowall.
Mm.
And his drawings of the film, he could have easily just recreated those drawings and people would have been happy. But he doesn't.
He doesn't do that.
They're very different drawings. And in all the cases, My Fair Lady, he chooses for the film, he chooses the Ascot races scene.
Mm.
Whereas for the play, he drew sort of when Henry Higgins meets Eliza Doolittle.
Yeah, the before. The before picture.
Right, exactly. So two of them together really are before and after. Also around this time, he starts drawing films for the New York Times.
Mm.
I think I've told you in the past that for years they did not want him to draw films because they saw that as a photographic medium.
Interesting.
And so he only drew theater.
Hmm.
And then in 1965, he does a drawing of Ship of Fools.
Oh, right.
With Vivian Leigh, yeah. Surrounded by a real cavalcade of stars. Mm-hmm. And that's the first drawing he ever did for the Times of a film. And then they start asking him to do drawings of films, and some of those are, in the 60s, are Warner Brothers films. There's two that I can think of. Petulia, with Julie Christie and George C. Scott. Mm. Notable in my house because it's a rare film in which the Grateful Dead appear.
What?
They're not billed. It's a, oh, really? It's a concert scene. It flashes by, but yes, that is good old Grateful Dead. And then The Mad Woman of Shiloh. He of course, drawn the original stage production. But when Katharine Hepburn is in the film adaptation, Hirschfeld does a great portrait of her for the paper. He actually did a drawing of her in the same role for Warner Brothers, but it's this very funky scene of a bunch of tables with different people at all the tables. These were all people who were going to be appearing in new Warner Brothers films. Mm. At that time, it was Warner Brothers Seven Arts. Zero Mostel is in there. Gordon Parks, who was a great friend of Hirschfeld's, is in there. Danny Kaye is in there. They're all making these films. A number of the films nobody remembers, mm-hmm. or are not considered great works. Hepburn and Mad Woman of Shiloh, maybe not as her greatest film, but he drew them in these roles, and then he, soon thereafter, he's drawing Hepburn in that role for the New York Times. And then in the 70s, he's still doing drawings for the New York Times of Warner Brothers films. There's a great one of What's Up, Doc? Barbara Streisand and Ryan O'Neill. And another one of Richard Benjamin, Karen Black, and another figure in Portnoy's Complaint, which, again, are kind of funny films. Not exactly what you thought. Maybe What's Up, Doc? Seems like a normal thing for Hirschfeld to be drawing. Portnoy's Complaint is a little bit different. He also draws Jane Fonda, who is already wearing her haircut for the Warner Brothers film Clute. And that drawing is so iconic, it was published as a print. And then one that people always ask us about, this is the one we should have, that Hirschfeld should have published as a print, Stanley Kubrick editing A Clockwork Orange.
Yeah, we always do get questions about that.
And that was a Warner Brothers release, but it was not done as part of the Warner Brothers publicity. The ones that he did do, it's a pretty, again, another films that are considered classics now. Robert Altman's The McCabe and Mrs. Miller. He does The Goodbye Girl, which Neil Simon's The Goodbye Girl, which is interesting because in the film, the film concerns an actor who sublets his apartment and then needs to move back in. Richard Dreyfuss is the actor. Marcia Mason and her daughter, Quinn Cummings, is the people that move in. And of course, it's they don't get along, and it's a real
it's a real odd couple situation.
It's a real odd couple situation, and of course, they fall in love. Oh. But since it's an actor's apartment, the set decorator obviously thought, "How can we convey that?" So on the wall is an exhibition poster of Hirschfeld drawings, and so he did a drawing for the film. And he's sort of in the film as well. Mm-hmm. I think that may be the only time that happened. Well, Main Street to Broadway, 1952. He does the drawing that is essentially the signature image of the film, and he appears briefly in the film. But yeah, those are the only two. He does a number of other film adaptations for Warner Brothers. Obviously, they see him as the go-to guy for that. Lucille Ball and a very poorly conceived adaptation of Mame. People will fight me on that. I love looking at The Prisoner of Second Avenue. You know, when he drew it on stage and Peter Falk and I think it's Lee Remnick.
Yes, I think because she was in an episode of Columbo we watched. And I said, oh, this must be where they met.
Yes.
It was the same year. It was like 62 or something, whatever.
Oh, no. This is 70.
Maybe it was 72.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, they must have met on Prisoner of Second Ave. And then he invited her on the show.
But, the film drawing shows,
who's in the film?
Right. The stage drawing is interesting because I think it really captures the sort of the Peter Falk feeling hemmed in, like, but almost resigned to his fate. Mm. Whereas the film drawing shows Jack Lemmon in that role And he looks like he's about to jump off the page and slice your throat. He's holding like a knife or something. And Anne Bancroft is his wife in it. And while they are seemingly set in the same, you know, sort of setting, the film drawing is much more sort of antic because Jack Lemmon is just...
It's crazy.
He's crazy, you know. He also did a... the film adaptation of The Ritz, Terrence McNally's The Ritz, with the late, great Treat Williams is in that drawing.
R.I.P.
Another film that is worth mentioning in this period is a pretty unique film. It is a film written by Stephen Sondheim and Anthony Perkins. It has no music. He didn't write the music.
He
Sondheim and Perkins wrote the script. The film was called Last of Sheila. And it was a murder mystery.
Ooh.
A bunch of people are invited on this boat by this person that they all know. And they go out to sea and someone gets killed. I think Sheila.
Like Knives Out.
Yes, in a way it is like Knives Out. And what's so interesting about the drawing, which, you know, it's got James Coburn and Diane Cannon and it's got a lot of wonderful people in it. He, of course, hides Nina's in the drawing. Kind of wouldn't be a Hirschfeld drawing of this period without a Nina.
Of course.
But in addition to the Nina, he also hides the name Sheila in the drawing.
Oh, that's fun.
And this is a drawing that Sondheim owned. I had wanted to borrow it in 2001 for an exhibition we put together at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. I wrote to Sondheim, who was totally game for lending it. And then he got back to us and said, I'm sorry, I can't. Why can't he? Because the frame that it was in was screwed to the wall. Like it was part of like the actual wall.
Part of the structure.
Yeah, you couldn't place something else in its place while it was gone.
Oh.
And while I regret not having it, I'm also glad that he does have it.
Yeah.
That he did have it. And of course, he was a very big fan of Hirschfeld and a big collector as well. So that is really the 60s and the 70s are the biggest era of Warner Brothers films after the 1920s.
After the
20s. And the other thing in the 1970s that he does, really almost for the first time in his career, in 1973 he illustrates the book The Lively Years. It was really a collaboration with Brooks Atkinson, where he used both old drawings and new drawings. And that's really the first time he looks back and is drawing productions that either he never saw or did not draw originally. In 1977, IBM presents a series on network television called Movies to Remember. I've probably referenced this before. You know, this was a big deal. It was just the start of the age of the VCR. And these movies were often presented with only one advertisement during the whole film.
Oh, wow.
We'd love for that.
Yeah, it's like, we got to get back to that.
Yeah. And among the films that he draws, originally, Treasure of Sierra Madre, it's a Warner Brothers film, Captain Horatio Hornblower, A Star is Born. And in 1979... they do this series again, but with different films. And there he draws Gary Cooper in the court-martial of Billy Mitchell. He gets another chance to draw Gwen Verdon in Damn Yankees, because he had drawn the original stage production. And then Spencer Tracy in The Old Men and the Sea. So his first retrospective work actually has a lot of Warner Brothers wrapped into it. None of those films he drew when they initially came out, although others in the series, like Singing in the Rain, he had drawn when it originally came out.
But they weren't Warner Brothers.
Precisely.
Right.
And that's what we're here to talk about today.
Yeah, we're talking about Warner Brothers, David. Get out of here with Singing in the Rain.
Gene Kelly fans, you'll have to wait for another episode. Finally, in the 80s, he does... a pretty classic film, Arthur.
I'm surprised Arthur was never made into a print, to be honest.
Again, I
think people would have gone for an Arthur print. I think people would now.
Right.
Even.
You know? I agree with you. What I also can't understand is why Arthur was never turned into a stage musical. Because it seems like it would be a natural.
David, it's only 2023.
Yeah.
Everything's now a stage musical, so just wait your turn.
Okay.
It'll come.
He does do one other stage adaptation, which is Death Trap. You know, the IR-11 play that was adapted into a film with Michael Caine and Christopher Reeve. The last drawing he does for Warner Brothers is not a movie that is well known. Maybe for good reason. I've never seen it.
I've never even heard of this movie.
Burt Reynolds and Clint Eastwood in a film called City Heat. They play detectives in New York, and the film shows the two of them in trench coats and hats in front of a New York City background. And it was probably the best thing about the film. is the
Herschel drawing. It happens more than you think. It happens all the time.
He did other films. I haven't listed all of them. These are the most significant. One thing I also want to point out he did in the 1980s is, in 1982, he illustrates the only play of his whole career, which is Streetcar Named Desire. He does not use imagery from the multiple stage productions he had already seen at that point. He uses the Warner Brothers film as his visual reference.
And he had not drawn that the movie previously.
No. In fact, he did not draw the original stage production. That also was in 1947 when he was traveling around the world.
Wow, he missed so much.
Oh, yeah.
What else did he miss?
Allegro. Rodgers and Hammerstein's Allegro.
Yeah, yeah.
Brigadoon.
Wow. All right. Big year.
You think 9 months, you're going to essentially miss one season. How much could you miss? And it turns out it's a very fertile period.
Wow.
So when he illustrated this publication of Streetcar...
So it's like the whole play is written out,
the whole play. It was done for the limited edition book club, which was... They did fancy editions, you know, deluxe editions of famous works. Almost always they were novels or collections of short stories. And a lot of different artists did it. But in 1982, they're going to do Streetcar. And... I mean, who else would you get to illustrate
to do a play? Yeah.
But Al Hirschfeld. It's got a foreword, I think, by Jessica Tandy, who was the original Blanche DuBois. It's a very beautiful edition. They sell now for about $250 if you can find one.
And how many drawings are there in the book?
12? Oh, there's 12? About 10.
10, yeah.
10 drawings. And the reason why we can say Warner Brothers Films, because the Blanche DuBois is easily recognizable as Vivian Leigh.
Right.
And Stanley Kowalski is very definitely Marlon Brando. When you see the his friends who come over to play cards, we can definitely see Carl Malden. And, you know, so it's not like, oh, I wonder, he must this have pulled from the, different ones.
It's not, these aren't the generic portrayals of these characters. These are very specifically Brando and Leigh.
Right.
In these roles.
The Stella is probably the most generic, which I don't understand why, but there it is.
Yeah.
The image of her, the one image of her in the book is somewhat generic. But again, it's a Warner Brothers film directed by Ilya Kazan, who directed the original stage production. And it just adds to sort of all the Warner Brothers material that that he drew, whether it was for the studio, whether it was for the newspaper, or whether it was for a special situation like the like limited edition book club.
Interesting. Kind of did it all with Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
All that's left is prints.
Yes. Some prints are of Warner Brothers films. One of them, Maltese Falcon, was actually taken from his Movies to Remember series in 1977.
Oh, so from that series in the New York Times.
Well, that's an ad that appeared in newspapers across the country.
Oh, gotcha.
It was a full-page ad in which the drawings were there.
Yeah.
And you looked at... In 77, it was just drawings of the films all sort of gathered together. They might have a number next to it. So you would look at the bottom of the page and say, oh, Stormy Weather. You know, that type of thing. And then in 1979, the ads look almost like a calendar. And each day... has the stars of the films around a director's chair.
Mm-hmm.
And the director's chair would either say the name of the film, but usually it actually told you the times and the dates it was going to be on.
Right. That's cute.
Yeah. So, and he did many great films for that, some being Warner Brothers. But The Maltese Falcon comes from that 1977 series. It is, not surprisingly, Bogart and the Maltese Falcon.
The Falcon, as they say in the movie. That's how I always say it now. I want people to know. I know.
The football team, how do you pronounce their name?
In Atlanta. The Falcons? The Falcons.
Yes.
No, but this is the Maltese Falcon. Okay. It's different, David. It's not football.
Okay, Sydney Greenstreet. but then there were two drawings he did of Warner Brothers films, classic Warner Brothers film. In fact, perhaps the most classic Warner Brothers film that he did exclusively for Prince. The first one is James Cagney in Yankee Doodle Dandy, one of the all-time classics.
That's a fun one.
It is. If you haven't seen the film, do yourself a favor and go watch it.
I have not seen the film.
Oh my gosh, you really got to see it.
Really?
It's James Cagney as George M. Cohan, and it'll blow your mind. There are some dance sequences in there. You're like, I didn't know James Cagney could do that.
Oh, okay.
It's a great story.
Are we talking like Royal Wedding, or is it going to blow my mind like that?
I think it could.
Okay.
And you missed the best day to watch it, which was July 4th.
That's true. That's true.
But you shouldn't wait until next July 4th to see it.
I don't know, David. I've got a long list.
And strangely, while the film is black and white, the print is not.
No, the print has color.
It has an American flag in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the other film, and I would say this is the most famous Warner Brothers film.
Of all time.
I would say it's of all time.
Yeah.
It is one of the few Warner Brothers films I've seen multiple times, and I would watch it again.
Really?
Well, you know what film I'm talking about.
Casablanca.
Casablanca.
See, it's not Casablanca. It's Casablanca.
Yeah.
The Maltese Falcon. And I'd like to point out, so there's actually two prints of Casablanca. There's a limited edition etching and a limited edition lithograph. They are essentially identical.
Very close. One has the background images in the background.
Yeah, the background is different in the one. So I'd like to, there's four prints of Warner Brothers films.
Yeah.
And I'd like to point out Humphrey Bogart is in three of them out of the four.
Well, he was one of their biggest stars.
He must have a contract with Warner Brothers.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, he was one of their biggest stars. And not surprisingly, I mean, imagine you're Humphrey Bogart. And you've made Casablanca, and you've made Maltese Falcon.
Falcon. See, he's already changing his ways.
Yeah, I'm trying to...
What else is Humphrey Bogart in?
Angels with Dirty Faces.
Never heard of it.
Key Largo. Mm. Yes, he's in a lot of films. You want me to look him up? He's in a number of classics, but...
What's that movie I watched? Dark Victory.
Yeah.
He's in Dark... Isn't he in Dark Victory?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not one of his greatest roles.
No,
but,
they hadn't figured out his sex appeal yet. So he was like living in a barn or something. Like, he was creepy. They hadn't figured out, women will go for this if we clean this guy up. So...
I've often wondered about that. Yeah. Like, what is it about this guy?
He's brooding. He's... Oh, handsome, really? In a non-traditional way. It's
That's
different.
What people say about me.
It's different from Claude Rains. You know, Claude Rains is handsome in a non-traditional. Claude Rains is handsome in a much more traditional way, I guess. But Humphrey Bogart, maybe you wouldn't understand. It's just he's got the charisma.
Yeah,
you know, he knows how to work it.
Definitely.
How to work it.
I can understand that. Now, Lauren McCall.
He shouldn't be a leading man.
He shouldn't
be.
Yes,
but he is. Yeah.
Well, I think it's that
Lauren Bacall. Lauren Bacall's Hot Stuff.
Oh, Hot Stuff.
Yeah,
and she remained.
Oh, I
hot
watched
stuff.
That. The To Have and Have Not. That was where they met.
Oh yeah,
that was a good film. I liked
that. Is
that
a good
one.
Film.
Yeah, that was a great one.
Oh yeah. While we will have links to all the images that we've referenced in the show notes, you can go to our advanced search and put in Warner Brothers
as the publisher.
As the publisher.
Under publisher, put in
and you will see all the films that he drew for Warner Brothers. Not just, it won't have the New York Times drawings.
True. Right.
But it'll be all the drawings that he did.
Anything that was published through Warner Brothers.
Correct.
Yeah.
So that is Warner Brothers, 100 years of Warner Brothers. I'm going to say they couldn't have done it without Hirschfeld.
Mm.
They didn't do it without Hirschfeld.
Well, they didn't.
Yeah.
And almost from the very beginning.
Yeah, really. And, I mean, his last piece is 60 years later.
Wow, yeah.
That is a long time.
That is a long time.
And what's crazy about it is he had almost 20 years to go in his career.
Mm. Yeah, well, I was going to say, I mean, that's the one Casablanca print is, what, 98?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So, I mean, he really, it's more than 60 years, if you can't, if you're counting something like that.
Right.
You know.
If you look at all the Warner Brothers films that he did for whatever reason, yes, it's almost the entire career. We are going to, we're in a period now where a lot of studios are going to be celebrating centennials or significant anniversaries. So I think we're going to be doing more podcasts to celebrate these centennials because
thankfully Hirschfeld's involved in all of them.
Yes.
So. We don't have to worry about that.
I guarantee you, you're not going to hear any studio centennials that Hirschfeld wasn't involved in.
I don't know. Don't care.
Republic Pictures? No. We're not. You will not hear a podcast episode on that.
I guess Selznick doesn't really get a centennial, does it?
It is. Next year will be 100 years since they went out of business.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's how we'll honor them.
Yeah. People have asked us to do an episode on Selznick.
Oh, that would be fun. I love the Selznick drama. So much to say.
Well, then I can spend a
we
whole episode
We have to teach everybody about Flapper Wives.
Yes. You get some very interesting drawings.
Oh, you do. Yeah.
Maybe we'll do that. That's next year.
I always say the one thing I would steal from our archive is a Selznick piece.
Yes.
Yep.
Well, and what's my line?
Well, that's a drawing. That would be a lot harder to steal.
I tell you, folks, we do check her bag. I've said this before. We have to check her bag, her car,
the Selznick Distributing Corporation brochure.
Oh, my God.
That's what I want. That's what I want. It's so
beautiful. And friends,
if
you want to get it for her, you will not find it on eBay. You will not find it.
I've actually never even checked.
You can't find it in the wild.
You don't think?
We may have the only copies. So listen, we've just sent a great list of episode ideas. If you have an episode idea.
Oh, please. We love hearing your ideas for episodes.
Because, you know,
because
Catherine,
we talk about the same stuff all the time. I mean, no, we don't. But we're so close to it, sometimes we forget about things.
Yes.
Like, I wouldn't have thought to do a Warner Brothers episode.
Right.
So, if there's something you're passionate about, Catherine, do all the Claude Rains films. You know, we'll do that.
Not
we'll do
happening.
A whole We'll do a whole Claude Rains episode. But
in
we need your
dreams.
Ideas. We need you to help us. What stories do you want to hear?
Yeah, so we've been getting some good suggestions.
Yeah.
So some of those will get put into the queue. I can't say they'll be the next episode, but we will put them in the queue, and we'll let you know if we're going to do them or not.
Yeah.
Listen, if you're listening to this, you could do us a big favor by rating and reviewing us on whatever podcast platform
yes.
you listen to us on.
I'd like to shout out our media manager, Doug Coons, who is so much smarter than I am and has put us on all the podcast apps. So it's really cool because I listen to most of my podcasts on Spotify. And now I can listen to my podcast on Spotify. I couldn't do that before. So you really can get us everywhere now.
Yeah, and that is thanks to Doug, who's doing a great job producing this. Leaves us to do the silly part, and he gets to do the hard part.
The podcast is on everything. Spotify, Apple, Amazon, Pandora, Google, and of course our website, alhirschfeldfoundation.org/podcast with an S. We haven't done this in a while. S stands for? I've got two.
Well, why?
Streetcar Named Desire.
Streetcar Named Desire.
Or Sidney Chaplin.
Sidney Chaplin. Yes, you're better at this than I am.
I'm pretty good.
But at our website, of course, you can look up anything that Hirschfeld ever did, by performer, by production, by publication, by year, by genre, by theater season. We try to make it as easy as possible for you to find what you want to look for and find things that you didn't know existed. If you have questions, comments, advice, ideas for episode, write to us at info@alhirschfeldfoundation.org.
And you can also reach out on our social medias. We always answer those, or we try to. Facebook at Al Hirschfeld, Instagram and Twitter at Al Hirschfeld, and our YouTube, Al Hirschfeld Foundation. I think if you just type that in, we'll come right up.
And if you go to our YouTube channel now, we just posted a new video, Hirschfeld Moment Episode 3. The moment Hirschfeld almost got fired from the New York Times.
That's a great story. I love that story.
Yeah. So worth checking out, and all the videos on our YouTube channel.
All right. Thank you all for listening. We hope you enjoyed the centennial celebration of Warner Brothers.
Thanks a lot, and we will see you when we do.
Bye.